Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Well, welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host, and we have a phenomenal guest on the show today, and we're looking forward to talking to Les Stevens. I'll give him an introduction in just a little bit, but I want to let you know this podcast of Training and Tactics Talk is dedicated to the training of our firefighters in the streets. And we really want to take training and tactics, you know, to the next level, exploring many topics and avenues to give our firefighters, our officers, our training officers, especially those folks who are out on the streets making critical decisions, all the information they can have, and put this in a huge library or resource for them to be able to go to pull from every day. And our whole focus on this is looking at the key essentials that are going to keep our people safe. And, you know, our efforts and Training and Tactics Talk is going to be that everybody goes home. And we want to do that through quality information, training concepts, and tactical considerations of today's fire service, not yesteryear's, but today's fire service. And in this show, we're going to focus on understanding critical factors that determine go and no-go strategy and tactics that are out there on the streets for our folks that are getting on scene very early, making some really good, you know, sound decisions, you know, with the buildings and the situations we're getting into. And we're going to really dive in, and we're going to explore some building anatomy thought processes and, you know, some really strong key topics that says we can make this a bunch safer out there on the streets for our folks, and we can get some things done in a very good, safe manner so everybody goes home in the fire service. And that's what we're after, is safer. Well, on the show with me today, it's an honor and a privilege for me to introduce a new friend that I met at the National Fire Academy. I've got Battalion Chief Les Stevens. Les has 17 years in the fire service, and he's currently a battalion chief with the Garland, Texas Fire Department. He's out there next to Rick Lasky for you folks listening. Great person here, and he's working on his executive fire officer program from the National Fire Academy. He's a certified master firefighter and instructor with the Texas Commission on Fire Protection. He's done a lot of training inside of his department. He's working with the Collin County Community College out in McKinney, Texas. He's been to FDIC instructing, which is, you know, really great that we got people like that, you know, out and about in, you know, the fire service world. And better than that, he's been down to Texas A&M, to the University of Municipal Fire School. He holds an associate degree in fire protection from Tarrant County Community College, a fabulous facility out there. Wished I had one in my back door, facility like that. So, Les, welcome on, buddy. And I told you that when we were at the Fire Academy talking about some of this that you would hear from me, and it's a privilege to have you on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chief. I appreciate you and Firehouse giving me this opportunity. Hopefully we can talk about some of these things this evening and share some information and hopefully even get some feedback from your listeners.
Well, that's what we want. And if our listeners are out there, you know, they can, you know, they can write in to radio at, you know, firehouse.com. Give us your ideas, your topics, your thoughts. If you've got questions, get it to us. We'll be glad to try to answer those for you. And before we dive into this critical factors of determining go and no-go, we had a really good question from the last podcast that I wanted to follow up on, and Les, feel free to jump in here too. You know, last time we talked about back to the basics and the philosophies that we needed to be looking at in training. And one of our listeners from up in New Jersey, I believe, wrote in and said, you know, what is back to the basics? Are we really, you know, we gave a lot of information, we hit a lot of areas, but are we looking at the essentials? And when he says essentials, you know, where I take this is the Essentials of Firefighting, you know, book, the NFPA 1001 standards. And what I believe is that back to the basics has to be tailored to each department. You can't just say, okay, we're going to do exactly what the book says, because there's going to be situations to where that doesn't just fit exactly in. you know, the demographics of your community, the types of buildings that you respond to, the number of personnel that you may have. And I related this in an answer back to this gentleman, is that, you know, departments that are running three-man engine companies have to, you know, become very efficient in how they do operations versus, you know, a group that has an additional one or two people on it, if they're that fortunate. Everybody's going to have a multitude of roles rather than just a single role. So when we look at back to the basics training, you know, it's getting down and dirty, doing the things for skills, the critical skills that are going to make or break the fire service. So Les, I'm going to pass the microphone over to you, as we would say, and what's your thoughts on this question of what is the essentials of back to the basics before we get into go and no-go?
Yeah, Chief, within my department and also here at Collin County at the college that I work at on my days off as a in-service operations instructor, when we talk about back to the basics, and I think you're exactly right, I think it's based on the specific organization, you know, that you're talking about. But what we're talking about is moving away from weapons of mass destruction training, moving away from the angle and the rope and the swift water, and getting back to what we call in the state of Texas, the Texas Commission on Fire Protection refers to as track A stuff. And that's you know, the hose deployment, personal protective equipment, ladders, pumping, things that were covered in rookie school that our guys that have been at the station on the streets for a while haven't spent a lot of time doing. And instead of having them, you know, sitting in class learning about, you know, C. Burney and different things like that, let's take them back and let's review, and hopefully that's what it is for them. It's not an insult to their intelligence. It's just a good review of those core competencies they have to go out and do the 95% of the work we do every day in the fire service. And that's when we talk about back to the basics. That's what we're talking about, is rookie school fundamental type stuff that the guys have to do to really get in the game.
And again, I just want to echo Les, you're exactly right. I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think we've lost some of that. So that just really leads into what we're going to talk about today. And to give our listeners a little bit of how we got into this, we were at the National Fire Academy, and Les is in his first year of the Executive Fire Officer Program, which, you know, I commend you for doing that, Les. It's the first step in really progressing forward and getting an opportunity to learn some things that, you know, is critical for officers. And we got to talking about a couple of things that are probably near and dear to my heart, and obviously they are to you, is that numbers aren't going down in this business when we're talking about firefighter safety and survival as far as everyone going home. And we really got to talking about there are times that people are just doing things they shouldn't be doing. We're going in where we shouldn't be going in. And I think the canned phrase came up by one of the gentlemen sitting at the table of, we're going in where angels fear to tread. And that really struck me and set in my head and just kind of echoed around for many days, on, you know, a couple of weeks. And as I went to exploring this topic even more and doing more research and talking about this in a program that I did down in South Carolina, that the combined conference there of the firefighters and the fire chiefs, you know, there are some critical factors that determine whether we go or no-go into some of these buildings, and it helps us decide strategy and tactics. So, you know, we talked about five critical things that we thought were go and no-go, you know, over a course of a couple of days when I was up there with the grants review and you were in the EFO program. And the first one that hit me is one that we know we've got some problems with. And we talked in the comparison of bread and butter operations on residential structure fires that we're running to in our community, what we run to the majority of the time, and then all of a sudden we're on this commercial alarm. And we're trying to take these tactics of residential structure firefighting and put them into commercial firefighting, and they just don't fit. It's like trying to take a square peg and put it in a round hole. One of the things that we talked about and brought up, and I'm going to basically verbatim where we wrote this down, was topic number one on go or no-go, we need to be evaluating our commercial structures. And if it's got 25% or more involvement you know, in the structure, do we need to go or not go? And we came up with basically we think we don't need to be going. And I'm going to pass it to you, Les, and let's talk about this a little bit.
Absolutely. First, I'd like to kind of say, and I think it's always important to mention, as you have these discussions, we certainly do so with the utmost respect for those who have gone before us. And a lot of times the things that cause these conversations and hopefully these lessons are the line of duty deaths, the tragic loss of our brothers and sisters within the fire service. And, you know, the thing that they have left to offer us, I believe, is that we might learn from the mistakes or the tragedies that befell them. So I want to make sure that we address that from the outset, that you can't really have this conversation without referring to some of those, and we do that with a great respect for them and their memory. One of the things that I wanted to address and that we were talking about there at the Fire Academy is, despite, you know, the last 30 years, despite an increased awareness and even increased training in the fire service, we still haven't seen a dramatic, consistent decrease in the number of line-of-duty deaths at commercial building fires in the United States. And to carry that one further, Bob Bennett from the National Fire Academy puts out a trade publication once a week, a training resource and data exchange. And one of the things that Bob includes on there, and I've always been fascinated with it, is the line-of-duty death statistics for the United States through that point in the year as compared to the worldwide line-of-duty death statistics. And for your listeners who aren't aware, and one of the things that's always kind of struck me, and one of the things I hope that, you know, guys like you and I and other leaders in the fire service today can hopefully address and change, is that the United States runs about double what the entire rest of the world does in line of duty deaths annually. And there's a couple of things that are being done. Stress is by far number one. Heart attacks, and strokes and things like that. And there's people that are carrying the torch on those, and they're being addressed on many fronts. The second one, responding to and returning from alarms. I think Chief Goldfeder has hit this dead on the head. You know, slow down. Don't drive like an idiot. Wear your seatbelt. You know, and if we would just apply those things, we could solve that one. The one thing that we seem to keep having reoccur that we aren't addressing adequately, apparently, is the collapse of commercial buildings on our people. And we go back all the way back to July of 1988 to Hackensack Ford. You know, we lost five firefighters there. 10 years later, the Precious Faith Temple Church in Lake Worth, and two of the three guys there that were killed were good friends of mine. We lost three people there. Houston, Texas, almost a year to the day later, we lost Kim Smith and Lewis Mayo in the collapse of a truss roof at a McDonald's. Worcester, Massachusetts, the cold storage warehouse fire in December of 1999, six firefighters lost there. And then recently, you know, Charleston, South Carolina, the Sofa Superstore in June of 07, nine firefighters. And I do a lot of instructing, and I try to brag on our members, our firefighters from across the country, of how intelligent they are and how smart they are. And this just seems to be one of those lessons that's escaping us, because we keep killing our people in these buildings unnecessarily. And I think it's probably our rules of engagement, and that's what I think you and I are talking about this evening with the strategic decision makers on go and no-go, you know, hopefully at commercial building fires. So that's kind of the background for me on this subject, is what do we need to change? What are we not arming our people, our officers, and our incident commanders with that would help them make decisions so we can stop that pattern?
Well, Les, you're exactly right. And, you know, bottom line comes down to it, you know, we all feel those effects. And when we talk about this commercial deployment of go or no-go on these structures, and we apply residential tactics to a commercial structure, it doesn't work. And when we're seeing that 25% fire involvement on a building, that 25%, and we use that number in our head because that's what we're taught on these fire formulas. Well, 25% of a commercial structure most times is the same thing as a fully involved residential structure fire that we wouldn't go in, but just because it's 25%, we're going to try to engage. and we try to take in, you know, the wrong hose lines. You know, that was brought out in the Charleston incident. And it's so, we get so complacent, I guess, that we pull 1¾-inch hose lines off of trucks, you know, day in and day out. I've seen this, you know, constantly in the fire service. I've seen it, you know, within my own department as, you know, we train, we go to these residential fires, then all of a sudden you get a commercial alarm. It's almost second nature. That's what you just do. What we have to do, I think, on this is for these strategies of looking at the commercial structures is if it's 25% involved, how much water is it going to take for us to get control of it? And we'll continue talking about some other factors that go in there, but 25% involvement of, say, a 10,000-square-foot structure, you know, that's a significant amount. That's a large amount. And what's in that structure? You know, what's your fuel loading? Those are the things that we have to really, I think, you know, consider on that topic. And, you know, how fast can we deploy these hose lines? How fast can we get, you know, if the fire flow needed is 1,500 gallons a minute, how fast can we put hose lines in place to get 1,500 gallons a minute? You know, how fast can we get a deluge, you know, gun system at a door or, you know, at a critical point in the building that we can actually operate and flow, you know, 1,000 to, you know, 1,250 gallons a minute off of some type of a deluge gun system or a master stream system? How many 2.5s can we get in place? You know, what type of nozzles are we carrying? It goes far beyond this of truly having what I call situational awareness, not only of the situation you're battling, but the, you know, your situational awareness of what your capabilities are, your training of your people, you know, the equipment that you're carrying on the truck, you know, those type of things. And I don't want to give away a couple of the other topics we're going to talk about, you know, down here, you know, in some of this, but, you know, right there is a critical piece. You got anything to add to that, Les, before we move on?
Yeah, a couple of things, and I think you touched on it. I think there's two components here. There's applying residential tactics to a commercial building fire, and I know some of the departments in our area have started referring to their 1¾, their 1½ attack lines as residential lines, rather than, you know, a booster or a big booster. They're actually calling them residential lines, and they're calling their 2.5s commercial lines, just to give that officer one last opportunity to recognize, you know, did he order a residential line through the front door of a commercial building? And hopefully that'll key him in. And I think we go back here to your gentleman from New Jersey with this question about back to the basics. And I know this is something that we haven't done a lot of training on in our department until recently, and that is how many of our guys have actually gone out and deployed through an occupied structure a charged 2.5-inch line. And do they understand the concept of prioritizing that first line? And will the incident commander allocate, you know, possibly two companies to just getting that line in place on the fire? And then secondly, the square footage that we're talking about, and you brought up 10,000 square feet, and that's a good starting point. But we have a lot of structures out there that are much larger. And just doing some rough math here on your 10,000 square foot building using the National Fire Academy's fire flow formula of length times width divided by 3, you're looking at, for 25% involvement, you need a fire flow in excess of 800 gallons per minute. So if we say that we can easily attain 200 gallons per minute out of our 2.5, and hopefully a little more than that, we need to put 4 of them in service. All of our apparatus are equipped with 1 2.5-inch line. So I've got to get 4 apparatus in position, or I've got to strip the 2.5-inch lines off of other apparatus and connect them to that pumper to achieve that. And then most likely at 2 companies per line, I'm looking at needing a total of 8 companies just to put 4 2.5s in service in this building. And is that realistic? And what's the reflex time on actually getting that done? And then if you extrapolate that same concept out to a 200,000-square-foot building, which we have several of in our district, in our city, warehouses, one of them has no less than 33 million Gatorade and Kraft plastic bottles in it at any one time. That's all they do is warehouse plastic bottles for different distributors and manufacturers within our city. That fire flow itself is daunting. So I think we need to look at that, and then we also need to, as part of our pre-fire plan program, decide, can we really develop a sustainable water supply to mount that attack? You know, we may be able to charge those lines, but can we continue to supply them throughout the incident with the kind of fire flow that it's going to take to realistically believe we can put this fire out? And then the last thing along those lines, Steve Kreis and Chief Brunicini from Phoenix and their work on the rapid intervention isn't rapid. You know, they talk about, you know, how deep in a building you can be and get off a line and anticipate being able to escape. And I think we look at that, too. Where is the seat of the fire from our point of entry? And we need to work, you know, our idea on a lot of residential stuff is the first line through the front door, and I totally endorse that. In a commercial building, that may put you at a 200 to 300-foot stretch, which is just not realistic for our people, especially pulling a 2.5-inch line. So I think there's a lot of things that come into play, but I think that 25% or greater involvement should definitely be a no-go indicator on a commercial building.
And I agree. And one of the last little things we'll wrap up on this number one topic is how many people have ever actually been involved in a live fire training event in a commercial structure? You know, I had the fortunate opportunity as a fire chief in the city of Eden to be able to take a building that qualified as a commercial structure, work with the Office of State Fire Marshal from North Carolina, and bring in, you know, some additional resources, prep this building appropriately to take people in and to show them what it was really like to be in a commercial building, the distances of travel, the hose manipulation, the use of much larger lines. And some folks got a real reality check. Ultimately, we were a very young department, and, you know, that, you know, really played into the mentality of these people on the essentials. These were young firefighters that were learning this, and we took our older people that were involved at an officer level, and it was just phenomenal, a great training experience. And you're right, we have got to train on this stuff. So let's move on to number two, and it's going to talk about anatomy of building construction, particularly truss construction and the presence of fire in buildings with truss construction. And I'm going to let you lead off on this. This is a real passionate subject of yours that I picked up on in our conversations.
Absolutely. This is one of the ones that really gets me. And there's been a lot of neat stuff going on this front. NIOSH put out a report in 2005 that emphasized some of the dangers of truss construction, and they didn't really isolate any one, bowstring versus steel bar joist versus parallel cord or scissor trusses. They spoke to the dangers associated with all of them, and I encourage your listeners to go online to NIOSH and research this report, and it's got a lot of good information in it. But when we do our classes, and specifically our lessons learned from the Precious Faith Temple, it was a scissor truss, you know, spanning a large area, not a large amount of fire showing from the outside, and it collapsed and killed three people unexpectedly. And one of the things that sticks with me is the vent crew kept saying the roof felt firm. Well, it did, and I think it's important for our firefighters to understand that the roof may feel firm, but what we're talking about, regardless of the structural system below it, is we're referring to the decking, be that 1x4 wood plank, be that 3/8-inch plywood or OSB, all the way up to a steel pan on a steel bar joist. They can't talk to you and give you an accurate report about the condition of the structural support below it. All they're talking about is the decking itself. And what we see in a lot of these is a failure of the truss system, the support system under it, but not a failure of the decking or the roofing material. And I think that's one of the things that we've been lured into, is believing that we can accurately assess those. Secondly, I think one of the missed concepts on this is the presence of fire in that void space. I think we don't investigate those as aggressively as we should, and I think we've also taught our people over, you know, the last 20 years, you know, my career in the fire service, we've handicapped them by giving them a unrealistic amount of time that they might believe they can operate safely in one of these buildings. And I know the number 20 minutes was real common, you know, as I was going through my training early on in my career. And in doing our preparation for this line of duty class that we did, we didn't find anything over 21 minutes. And yeah, those are the only ones that were documented, and we only document the ones where there's a line of duty death, and now we're getting a little better by documenting near-miss occurrences. But I think we've equipped our incident commanders and our line officers with some bad information. 21 minutes, if you subtract out, you know, the notification of the fire department, the response time, and then the reflex time of actually getting our crews inside and going to work, a lot of times our on-scene time will be well under 10 minutes when we're seeing these collapses. And I think we've just given them an unrealistic expectation. So I think the presence of trusses has to be a consideration when you're talking about go and no-go, and especially if the fire involves the truss components themselves. There's also been a little work going on. I wish I could recall who passed the legislation, but they're looking to put a placard, much like we use an NFPA 704 for our fixed hazmat facilities. They're looking to put a placard on the front doors of buildings just to notify the firefighters as they're entering the building that there is a truss there, and they do need to be aware and use their thermal imagers, the reach of their stream, you know, to investigate the environment above them. And I think we have to be willing to back out and go defensive on those if there's fire involving that that roof system.
You're exactly right, and there's so many cases out there. If you look at the near misses and you look at you know, case studies where there were line of duty deaths, that there was structural failure, and you know, we talked about a lot of the roof systems, but it comes down to more than that. There's floor systems that are being built. There's roof systems that are being built. And it's not just what we think of as the typical trusses where they've got gusset plates, you know, in the wood frame trusses that go in some of the, you know, the newer modern design. I remember years ago when I began working on rapid intervention training back in the, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s, Francis Brannigan made the comment that, you know, there's five types of building construction, and then there's the type six, and he called it the other. And it's where you combine a lot of things together that nothing is exactly the same as any of the you know, type one, two, three, four, five. It's kind of a hodgepodge. And we look at what's being done, you know, today. They take an OSB board, you know, that's basically wood chips, it's glued together. They make, you know, a nice, you know, pretty, you know, cut on a 2x4 or, you know, a 2x6 style hard piece of lumber, marry them together and form a truss. And, you know, they say it has a great fire rating. Well, absolutely it does, but it does terrible under heat. And that's part of what we're dealing with is, you know, when we start heating things up in the wooden side, we're seeing the failure, the catastrophic failure of the anatomy of that wood itself. It's breaking down. It's falling apart. So you're right. This is a definite consideration in tactics for go and no-go. And, you know, unfortunately, that's today's building world. Everything is engineered. And, you know, we got to get down to where, say, we're not going to go anymore. It's a no-go. And I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I know you're very passionate about that. Well, we're at a point in time I think we need to take a break. You're listening to Training and Tactics Talk on RadioFirehouse.com. We look forward to having you back in just a few moments. We'll be back right after this message.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Well, welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk. Again, this podcast on training and tactics is dedicated to the training of our firefighters in the streets, our company officers, the training officers, giving those folks, you know, the right materials to make sure that everyone goes home and that we're doing a job much safer, much more efficiently, and with a lot more knowledge. And, you know, today I've got on the show, welcoming back Les Stevens, again, the battalion chief with Garland Fire Department out in Texas. And we're in the understanding of critical factors that determine whether you go or you don't go when you're, you know, making your fire ground strategy and tactics on arriving. The next one we got up that we really want to talk about, we touched on, you know, initially a little bit, want to dive into it much deeper, is the adequate water supply and the delivery methods. And we won't spend as much time on this because we touched on it, but I'm going to lead off with this a little bit, Les, if you don't mind, is that, you know, water supply is a big deal. And when firefighters are rolling in, they have this vision that they can put the fire out. And that, you know, if we get, you know, hose lines deployed, if we get in place, if we, you know, can just do the things that we're trained to do, we can put it out. I agree wholeheartedly. The problem being is you have to have what is the suppression agent. And what we use the majority of is water. And even though you got a hydrant system, and this is where people get lulled into that false sense of security, you pull up and your hydrant system says, hey, we've got, you know, this great hydrant flow hydrant right in front of us. And it's color coded, and we got over 1,500 gallons a minute, supposedly by, you know, the NFPA classification, and we're ready to go, and we got this big commercial fire. How much water do we really have, and is it going to be adequate, and can we really do what we need to do to deliver the suppression agent onto the fire to adequately control it in a timely manner and do it accurately and safely? So I'm going to pass it back over to you, Les. My opinion on this is that we don't do a real good job of truly looking at water supply. And we talked about this, but I want you to touch on it again.
Yeah, Chief, I think you're exactly right. I think that the key word here and the one that we use is sustainable. You know, we're lulled into a false sense of security. We arrive there with, you know, 500-plus gallons on our engines, 300-plus gallons on our trucks. I'm fortunate I work in a completely developed area and residential. You know, I have a hydrant every 500 feet and commercial one every 300 feet and a superior rated water supply system. So I can't even comprehend what some of your listeners are up against when they're talking about, you know, developing, you know, relay and tanker operations, you know, to keep this kind of flow up over, you know, an extended period of time. Again, I think what I would challenge folks to do is when they're doing their pre-fire plans, and my department is good at this. We could definitely be better. We do excellent job on our pre-fire plans, and we go out and we actually use a wheel and we get true measurements. We don't guesstimate it, and we mark our hydrant locations and different things like that. What we don't anticipate, I think, is run the numbers, run the fire flow formula for 25% of that building, and then decide, do you really have the hydrants in close enough proximity to develop the fire flow, a sustainable fire flow, to put that building out if it's 25% or less involved? And I think that's the component we're missing. And I really wish I could think of the department. Just recently I read a line of duty report, and maybe you guys can help me. It sounded like this department had really done a good job being proactive and doing a pre-fire plan. I want to say the building was a lumber yard, and I don't remember if it was an indoor or outdoor lumber yard. And on the pre-fire plan, they had even noted what the fire flow from the hydrants was. And they had an incident there, and a line-of-duty death, or maybe even a multiple line-of-duty death occurred. And in the NIOSH report, it commented to the necessary fire flow for that building. And although what the hydrants were capable of delivering on the surface seemed adequate, when actually compared to the needed fire flow of that structure, it really wasn't. And I think that was very unfortunate, because it sounded like a really progressive, really professional organization that was trying to do something. And that one key component of comparing the two, comparing the needed fire flow and the available fire flow ahead of time. And I think that's what we've got to have our company officers and our incident commanders working on, is making a lot of these decisions at the kitchen table or at the table, you know, in the discussions ahead of time when they're talking about their pre-fire plans, and not having to make them from the hip, so to speak, when the incident's occurring.
This has happened to me, and you're exactly right. You know, you roll up and you're pulling up on this commercial fire, and they're catching hydrants, and we're going to work. And for the fire flow that was on this, and it was a convenience store, you know, a true type of fire that, you know, we had to go defensive because of the volume that we saw there, but, you know, trying to get just adequate water flow. And we were struggling. And I'm like, why are we struggling? The hydrants, you know, should be able to put this out. We were actually being affected in our water flows because of a major industry that was a major water user in town that was pulling so much water, and it was Miller Brewing. And they were making a major draw on the water system. And when we didn't get adequate supplies, the first thing I did was call, you know, to communication saying, notify the water plant and give me another pump system. You know, raise the pressure in town. I don't know what the problem is, but I need more water. And that we're in a defensive mode. And, of course, that's where you're right. Pre-planning does come in of how much water do you have, how fast can you go, when is it go or no go. And, you know, fortunately, at some point in time between when they could kick the pumps on and do a true evaluation of what the problem was, you know, the draw on the water system stopped. And all of a sudden, I got all this water. And I'm like, man, they must have kicked in two pumps. You know, and I was excited because we had that true, as you call it, sustainable water flow, which I didn't have to be able to do the amount of, you know, volume of fire versus, you know, the adequate amount of water flow to put it out. So that is super important, and people need to realize that. And it takes a lot when you're trying to strategically get around a building, get the hydrants, get them brought in. You know how fire scenes get. They get very congested. You can't get apparatus where you need to, you know, position them. You know, you can't get your truck companies in. You can't get engine companies in. So you have some issues, and it does take a lot of planning for that. The other side of this brings us to number four, which is really important in all aspects. I don't care what you're doing. It's having personnel. Do you have adequate personnel to do the job? And I don't think we look at that enough. I think the mentality that we have in the fire service is we can do more with less. And we know that that can't happen. We have to have adequate resources. And it's like deploying a 2.5. You know, this is something that I've had great lengths of discussion with people, you know, from various organizations that have had large commercial fires, have had problems, you know, even had line of duty deaths. And they've come to the conclusion, again, that you need two companies dedicated, at least four people dedicated to a 2.5 line to advance it. And part of what we're doing, and an active approach that I took, you know, being a fire chief, was that we had to develop a big box policy. And I know people are probably tired of hearing big box, big box, big box. But again, it goes back to one of the key issues that you said in a statement, Les, is that identifying or giving the right information to that company officer that's out on the streets, or the officer that's in rural America pulling up going, are we deploying residential tactics or are we deploying commercial tactics? And that's important. And it gives you that ability to kind of get cued information up that allows you to make strong strategy decisions. You know, with my tactical deployments, I know I got to have more people. If it's, you know, super deep, you know, and again, you talked about the entry point, first line through the front door, maybe that's not the best entry point. Maybe you need to relocate around to the back because instead of a 400 lay, it would only be a 150-foot lay from that direction. So that's something. And, you know, I'm going to shift it over to you. You're in a large metropolitan department. You know, you have multiple stations and multiple resources to pull from and a great, great infrastructure for automatic aid. So personnel is still probably challenging for you. And then I'll come back and I'll talk a little bit about rural America.
Absolutely. There's a couple of things I wanted to touch on. And you brought up that people are tired of hearing about the big box. They're also tired of hearing about working out and wearing their seat belts. And we haven't seen a dramatic decrease in the line of duty deaths there either. So when we see a decrease in the line of duty deaths, then I'll gladly stop beating on this drum. But for the time being, they're going to have to keep listening to me rattle about it and guys like you, and I appreciate you doing that. I think that until we see an improvement, these are things we need to keep in front of our members and especially the decision makers on our fire grounds. The resources, the trend in the fire service, and we've all seen this, you know, over the last few months, and as October approaches in many cities, fiscal year starts in October 1, we're seeing a reduction in force. We're seeing the laying off of firefighters. In our department alone, we have 11 stations, two of which have double companies. October 1st, we're anticipating shutting down two engines that will give us a single company and an ambulance at each of our 11 stations. So it's even affecting us here in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. I know some of the other departments in the area are suffering from the same exact problem. So we're seeing a reduction in personnel. And in many cases, like in my department, we weren't riding four around already. We were riding with three most of the time and four when we were heavy with staffing. So I think we need to start to look at and educate our guys on what they can safely accomplish with three personnel, because that's really becoming the reality in a lot of organizations is three is the norm rather than four. What can they adequately and safely accomplish with the number of personnel? And then secondly is looking at, like I talked about, prioritizing tasks. If getting the 2.5-inch line in service on the seat of the fire is the fire ground commander's number one priority, he needs to demonstrate that by allocating two companies and more if necessary to get that job done. If search is his number one priority, he needs to demonstrate that in some way by possibly allocating additional companies to accomplish that. But, you know, what is your priority? What is your number one concern? And I think a lot of times we run into incident commanders, and I'm always a little concerned when I hear somebody talking about, well, attack and search are my priority. Well, they can't both be. Pick one. You know, which one is your priority, and show me which one's your priority, and I'll know in a minute because I'll look at how you deployed your resources. And I think that's a big thing is where do they put their personnel and what are they trying to accomplish? And don't run short on several fronts. Actually put the people to work on the one thing that you think is going to make the incident better the fastest. And I think that's what we've got to work on training our decision makers to do, is recognize what they think the true single priority is and addressing it to completion, and then addressing those other tasks after that.
That's one of the things, and you bring this up, and that is so true, is, you know, I had the pleasure of working with the Fire and Emergency Training Network this past year, and we did a program called Hose Line Tactics. And we were fortunate enough to have them here in the city of Eden in North Carolina. And, you know, we discussed the rural side of America with staffing in that, along with, you know, your metroplexes. And a lot of times what happens is you just don't have the people to do the job. And you've got to decide what you're going to do. You know, are you going to deploy hose lines? Are you going to do rescue, just like you said? And you got to commit, folks, to those tasks. One of the things that I brought out in that, you know, having the opportunity to develop that program was you cannot adequately manipulate hose lines, especially in certain structures. And we can look at residential versus commercial on this all day long, but it doesn't matter. Each building proposes a very unique situation. And whatever that situation is going to dictate. And people want to get hung up of saying, oh, well, we need three people on that hose line, or we need four. Well, I've been in situations that we've deployed 2.5, and I needed 10 people. And if I need 10 people, I need 10 people to do the job. And that's where you get it. In rural America, you know, you talked about having, you know, the staffing, the three on the truck, stuff like that. You know, serving as a fire chief in a combination department, you know, I'm not really, quote-unquote, rural America in my district. I'm suburban, but I'm still taxed with the same problems. You know, when you're depending on volunteers to show up and there's a critical delay in their response simply because they got to get out of bed at night and respond in and try to get to the scene, get dressed. It's not like they're falling out of bed, you know, right at the apparatus, get on, and instantaneously they're going to be on scene in their district quick. You know, they may have to, you know, come from a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles away. So that becomes very difficult in deploying personnel, and it becomes, you know, down to the point, do you have adequate resources to go or no-go? And if you don't have them, bottom line, it's a no-go situation. Back up, regroup, do something a little different. If you do have them, you still got to go back and look at all these factors we talked about. Is it really safe? Are we addressing the true situational awareness of the situation we have, manpower, water supplies, the type of building, the fire involvement? And that just leads me right up to the last one we're going to talk about, which is risk-benefit analysis. True situational awareness, do we have it? What do you think, Les?
I think in a lot of cases, not necessarily. I think our guys are conditioned with that, as you talked about earlier, that can-do attitude and do more with less. And the most of them, for the most part, bring a very strong, you know, type A-plus personality to the fire station, whether they're career or volunteer or any, you know, any combination thereof. And I don't think we're conditioned to pulling up and making a decision to write off a structure. And one of the things, you know, that I use in some of my teachings on this, and it's always an eye-opener, and the training officers are welcome to use this, you know, I'll find the youngest, newest paramedic and in the room, and I'll ask him, you know, hey, will you tell me the five reasons that we don't initiate CPR on a victim or a patient? And they'll rattle them off, you know, decomposition, decapitation, dependent lividity, rigor mortis, head or chest injury, visibly incompatible with life. Just boom, 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 boom. And I'll go, man, that's great. I'm really impressed. And then I look to the senior officer in that room, you know, the senior, you know, be it a seat officer or an incident commander, battalion chief level, and I'll say, okay, chief, you know, now it's your turn. Tell me the five reasons that we don't initiate offensive strategies at a commercial building fire. And they just kind of stop and stare. And I think that's really the crux of what we're talking about is we know and we're uniform throughout the United States and what the criteria is to not work on a human, but we don't know and we haven't developed and decided on and agreed upon the criteria to not initiate offensive, interior, aggressive attack strategies at a commercial building. And I think that we need to do that. I think we're finding ourselves at a point with the different types of building construction, and again, the engineered components versus the mass, that we need to start to look at what are the reasons that we're not going to put our people in harm's way. Then again, that risk-benefit analysis, and I think a lot of it needs to be done at the kitchen table of the fire station and not when we pull up on the fire ground. I think a lot of these decisions can be made ahead of time.
And I think we got to also go away from this mentality that when they come out of the academy, and I've heard this so many times, and, you know, I'm, you know, in the process of switching over from being a fire chief, you know, in a smaller department and going to being a training commander with the High Point Fire Department, which is a Metroplex-style department, is that when they come out of academies, whether it's in, you know, the volunteer ranks or whether it's in a full-fledged paid department, you hear folks say, well, that was great, you learned all that stuff, but this is how we do it. Well, you can't forget the stuff that you're taught, and I think that's part of our problem in our mentalities is that we condition people to believe that they can do anything. And we also train them to that way. You know, with back to these essentials that we're doing, we give them sometimes this false sense of security of just how well they can do things. And I believe that in our basic academies, we're missing this right here that we're talking about. This should be one piece that is talked about all the way through. When we're putting all these skills together, it should be, how does this apply to what you're going to be doing out in the field? Well, I think we're doing a great job of skills, you know, in academies and you know, teaching volunteers when they come in and giving them skills. I think where we're missing some things is that, you know, in paramedic school, it's conditioned. We're not doing exactly what you said, conditioning our firefighters to be able to say, hey, boom, 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 these are the five things. This is why you don't do it. And, you know, being able to have true reason behind it and understanding behind it. And I think that's where we got to go with some of our training. It's critical. You know, the good part about this, Les, is, and that's part of why you're on here, I want folks to know that this is what you're looking at for your EFO program, for your paper to do that first-line research. I think it's going to have a huge impact on the fire service as a whole. And I applaud you to, you know, a standing ovation for your efforts on exploring this, because I know this was something that we talked about, and it was just brought up, hey, this is a great EFO paper. There's nothing out there on that. There's no research. We need it. And that's something we got to do is get much better at looking at bigger pictures and the window to the wider world. And, you know, bottom line, we've got folks that say, oh, I'm aggressive firefighters. We're an aggressive fire department. You know, here's my take on that. They're not aggressive. They're reckless. And we're seeing it every day. And when people become reckless, we get people hurt injured, you know, to incapacitation of being able to be a firefighter any longer, to death. And that's unacceptable. You know, casualties is unacceptable in this business. We shouldn't be accepting that. And, you know, when you tell me, and I knew this, and we tell our listeners out there that we're double what the rest of the world is, we've got a problem. And when are we going to fix it? We know the issues. We're identifying even more here. You're going to provide us with some great research, and again, Les, great job. I'm looking forward to reading your paper and seeing this. And, you know, I think this has been a great podcast, and I really hope the folks are going to walk away as listeners and say, man, I've got some really good materials, and we can make our job safer. Les, thank you for being on. I appreciate all that you're doing in the fire service and the fire service community. You are a great leader in that, and I'm sure that Garland, Texas is fortunate to have you. Again, thanks for tuning in to Training and Tactics Talk. Come in next month. We got a great topic on board. You'll be hearing more about that, and keep tuned to firehouse.com. Training and Tactics Talk, radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for joining.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.